Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by my bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop. As I always say, because I like to brag, we just won Best Bookshop in Philadelphia and Best Coffee Shop. We're really pleased with that, mostly due to you guys who come and see us all the time and are very loyal. Today, our guest is Emily Mitchell, whose first novel was The Last Summer of the World, and that was all about Alfred Stieglitz and Edward Steichen. I always get their names confused. Photography and World War One, and a lot more. And that was really a great book. Her latest offering is Viral Stories, which will be published a couple days from now by Norton, and completely different. Emily's stories have also appeared in Harper's and Plowshares, and her essays have appeared in the New York Times and New Statesman. She teaches at the University of Maryland, I think, because she moves around. Viral is a collection of stories which have been written by a person who is obviously deeply troubled, has alien friends, when I say alien, not like from this planet, and has read a lot of Fodor guides. She's also hilarious and sometimes sad. I had a friend and an artist, and this I mean, Emily, as a compliment. He painted beautiful things, but every time anyone saw them, they would say something like, oh, I could do something like that. And he would say, well, then why didn't you? And some of Emily's stories are like that. She simply has the courage and the eloquency to open up the interior monologue that some of us experience in one way or another. And people might say, I could do that. But the answer is they already are doing that. That's why they could do that. Anyway, there may be better stories out there, but I haven't read them in a long time. So hi, Emily, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Sam. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, you know, I got the arc of Viral, and just looking at the cover and then starting to read, I just read straight through and didn't stop, didn't do anything else because it was just so cool. And I'm kind of joking, but like, it's almost like, what happened to you between your first novel and these stories? Mm. It's almost like something happened to you. Did it?
Quite a lot of things happened to me, but in truth, actually, I'm guessing that when you say that, you're asking why the stories are so different from the novel. And in truth, I was always interested in all of these different forms and in exploring all of the different shapes you can push fiction into. And how they work and what's possible when you use different kinds of strategies in your stories. This collection of stories really, was not a book that I started out thinking of as a complete integrated work. I wrote stories in a way as a holiday from when I was writing, they began as a holiday from when I was writing my novel, and novels take a long time, they require an intensity of focus, and sometimes when you're a writer you just want to feel what it's like to start something and finish it and have a complete story that you have managed to tell, sometime during the years when you're working on this longer project. So the stories were kind of, for me, they were like playtime. And it's only some, and then I was experimenting, to see what I could do with the short story. I read short stories in all of the different forms I can find them in, and so then I wanted to try writing them. And it was only later, looking back at all of the work that I had done in this form, that I began to see that there were enough things in common between the stories, even though, as you know from having read the book, some of them are science fiction, some of them are historical fiction, some of them are realistic, some of them are much more surreal and fantastical. But all of them have some kinds of themes and I think some tones in common that mean, that with the help of a very smart editor, I was able to put them together into a shape where it felt like the stories were communicating with each other, even though they're very, very different.
Yeah, I guess what I was looking at, and again, coming at it from just knowing these two works and also having read Three Marriages when it was mm-hmm. published independently and Lucille's House, which actually kind of are the two that are kind of different, actually, when you think about it. But it's like a difference of kind, not degree. It's like Elon Musk doing SpaceX, but mm-hmm. at the same time doing the Tesla, and the same mm-hmm. time doing, you know, the pneumatic railroad. It's like three completely different projects, and that's kind of how I felt. Mm-hmm. And especially like when I read like the first story, which is called Smile Report, what you do is you take this, and you do this throughout, is that you take these premises that are totally believable, mm-hmm. and then you use that premise to reach a conclusion that the reader has to decide, without spoiling anything, the reader has to decide whether, what did he just do? Did he do the right thing? Did he do mm-hmm. the wrong thing? Yeah, and then you know what he did. Mm-hmm. And then you're, what's really cool about it is you're kind of put into his place. And so that story just like, that hooked me, and that's why I said I just read straight through it.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, I think, you know, I'm so glad that you've, you know, that you felt that way and that you felt as though there is that element of, you know, when you're reading these stories, that you're kind of confronting some of the dilemmas that the characters do. Because one of the things, you know, and I was saying, it seems to me that the stories have, you know, these kind of overarching themes in common. One of them is the theme of bewilderment and confusion. Because, you know, it seems to me, and, you know, and in particular in that very first story, that one of the kind of experiences that I feel has for me been so characteristic, you know, of, you know, certainly the recent years of my life, is being confronted with such novelty in my environment in terms of technology and the ways in which people relate to each other through it, that, you know, that we're sort of, you know, we're struggling to understand often, you know, so, well, what is the right thing to do? Not, you know, right, good, you know, what is the thing that will put us, you know, in touch with each other truly, and what are the things that we might be doing to evade, you know, honesty and real communication? You know, even down to the question of, you know, do I really enjoy this? You know, I think, you know, there's so much that we're encountering that is so new that we're struggling to come to terms with. And so, you know, so the character in that story is, you know, is trying to figure out what matters in his life, in the way he relates to the people around him. And
you're kind of rooting for him. You're kind of rooting for him because you want him so badly to recognize what it is mm-hmm. that he's, you know, wrestling with. Mm-hmm. And so you're really, as a reader, you're really involved in a short story. You're really involved in saying, okay, come on, you can do it. Just do it, and then you have to whatever. It's hard, you know. I forget that there's people listening to this, so I end up just wanting to tell you exactly what I think about the story, and then that would give it away, and it's not even released yet.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm very curious to know what it is that you think. But I think, you know, that's part of the experience of reading the story is the frustration of, you know, of watching the character, you know, sometimes not always make the best decision.
Well, plus you gave the character to me, so I guess I can do whatever I want with him. But
that's true.
Yeah. But it's funny because you take Smile Report and then you move on to, say, On Friendship, and then you switch. Both of these are in first person. Mm. So, like, On Friendship, the thing about that is, and this is where I say you have courage, because although I don't know it, I do know that I go through this repeatedly, this progression in my mind where nothing's happening. It's just inside this 3 pounds of wetware that I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm taking something that probably doesn't mean anything, and it's almost like feedback. I'm just amplifying it and amplifying it and amplifying and going in recursive circles, and you somehow bring that out in this woman, that this is what she's doing. She's not really thinking about reality. She's thinking about something that is not really good for the human race in general.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's good for us or bad for us. My suspicion is it's bad for us, but I definitely think that it's a characteristic experience, you know, of, I mean, the character in On Friendship, you know, is in situations where she has relationships with people, but they're all at a distance. And because they're happening at a distance through phone calls or through social media, she is trapped inside her own head. And I think, you know, there's other stories in the collection. You know, there's a story later in the collection, which you probably will remember, about a character who has insomnia, which is almost that kind of dialed up to 11 of just being stuck in your head and thinking around and around something and somehow being unable to act. And I was really, you know, I'm really interested in that space between the moment where we figure out that there's something that is calling for our attention and possibly our action, and we're, you know, but we're not yet able to take a decisive, you know, to make a decisive act, or you know, even to make a decision in our own minds about how to go forward, you know. And I think that part of that has to do, you know, with the quantity of time, you know, and I don't want to generalize on, you know, about this too much, but it does seem to me that one of the directions, you know, of contemporary life is towards more time spent alone, thinking, and that that experience then becomes important to represent in fiction. You know, what is it like if, you know, the interlocutor you're talking to most of the day is actually on a computer screen, you know, or is on the phone, or, you know, or is on the other end of a series of text messages. You know, I mean, one of the reasons that I have always loved science fiction, you know, although I'm very, very interested in science and technology, what science fiction does is, it seems to me, explore how the changes in our material circumstances change our feelings and our perceptions and our self-understanding. And I was really, you know, interested in this collection in how does it feel to be, you know, the person, you know, who, you know, in the story On Friendship, is thinking about these friends who are far away and the number of phone calls they have made to each other, you know, and how many friends she has on Facebook, and, you know, whether they're enough and whether they're really friends of hers or not. So, you know, so it came out of a lot of experiences that I had had that I think are probably not just my experiences.
Yes, my friend calls your Facebook friends your invisible friends, like when you're a child and you have invisible friends. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's like. And one time I was riding down an elevator and these two girls had taken selfies of each other. And then they're watching Facebook and the one girl's going, "Oh, you already have 34 likes. That's because everyone likes you and no one likes me because you're so much prettier." Mm-hmm. And it was like, I wanted to say something, but I don't know what there is left to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's this whole other realm of experience. I mean, leaving aside the fact that you know, that this is a space in which you are only allowed to like things. you can't dislike. You can't, and you know, I mean, you can obviously, you know, in other ways, but that your way of thinking about your interactions is steered by this very, very simplified set of options that are presented to you by the interface, and that's odd, right? And so then, you know, sort of being liked and, you know, or not liked or not liked enough times becomes this whole aspect of your day and your emotional landscape. But I also don't want to, you know, and I think the book doesn't come down on the side of this is all bad, this is all terrible. What I was much more interested in is just the description, because clearly, you know, if people are, you know, people love social media, you know, and it you know, it's a big part of, you know, of many people's lives. And I don't want to just say, oh, you know, I wish it would all go away. I just want to look at how it shapes us and how it shapes our time and our relationships.
Well, it's kind of the curse of being a science fiction writer. Not that you are a hard science fiction writer, but
no,
it's
I'm
like
thrilled to be called a science fiction writer.
Me too. I would be too.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's really hard to be one now, like with Dave Edgar's The Circle. It's like you really can't step far enough away anymore because it's here. The stuff you'd be writing about is here. And so like Facebook or like texting, for example, you know, girls and boys breaking up by texting. Mm-hmm. Or if a girl texts a guy and he doesn't answer for an hour because he's in the shower, you know, is he mad at me? Or if you say hello but you don't put an exclamation point, mm-hmm. are you mad at me? Or if you don't put an emoji that's smiley face at the end, mm-hmm. why have you dissed me, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and in a way, you know, there were equivalents of this kind of thing in the past, you know, ways in which we signified to each other, you know, particularly with romance. You know, I'm in the moment for the project I'm working on in the moment, I'm doing a lot of research into, you know, the culture of the middle of the 19th century. And the description that you just gave of, you know, what an emoji means and what a reply to a text message means and, you know, sort of how we worry about, you know, about whether we've done and said the right thing has plenty of equivalents in other, you know, in other time periods. It's just that this is the way that we're playing out these dramas now. But, you know, I just wanted to speak also to, you know, to when you said, you know, it's really difficult to be a science fiction writer now because things change so quickly and by the time you imagine something, it arrives. I always think about one of my, you know, favorite sci-fi writers is the British writer J.G. Ballard, you know, who is, you know, he's known probably most well for his novel Crash, but the work of his I really love is his short stories. And he said, I think in an interview in the 90s, that what changed for science fiction writers is that the question became not what's next, but what now? You know, not what if, but, you know, but what, you know, what's the thing that's happening now that is so new and so strange that it's actually changing the way that we, you know, that we relate to each other and the way that we think about what it means to be a human being. And I, you know, that for me was incredibly revealing because the present is so peculiar, so dynamic and so transient that you can write about the present as a science fiction writer, you know, and evoke some of the same feelings, you know, that genre has always evoked, the feelings of fear and wonder, and curiosity.
But the thing is that it's become a much more difficult genre, I still contend, or maybe a different one, because all the seminal things have been written, whether it's Theodore Sturgeon or Heinlein or Bradbury or Clifford Simak or Fred Hoyle, all that's been written. There are no more space operas to write about, and no one would be interested in them anyway, other than in the movies, which every single movie is.
Mm-hmm.
But so what happens is, like you say, you have to take today and turn it on its head, which is what you do in your story, States and Itinerary, which is where, when I was joking about photos, because what you have is Solitary Sphere Travel, which is this travel agency, and it's telling you about, you know, you're reading about this United States that is not the United States. Here's where the science fiction comes in. It's not the United States at all, but then it clearly is the United States. Mm-hmm. And somehow you waltz between those two stages, and the reader, at least this reader, you know, is looking at it saying, yeah. Plus, it's really funny, right? I mean, you meant it to be funny, and it is funny, but it's a good way of looking at America from the eyes of a foreigner and saying, this is what's important about this country. Don't forget to see this. Don't miss this.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, so that story was, was basically me giving up on trying to write a more realistic, naturalistic story about a road trip across country that my husband and I took at one point when we moved from New York to California. I had kind of gone around and around trying to use that as a frame for a realistic work of fiction, and in the end, I just was like decided to, you know, to do this other kind of thing. And I think for me, the reason that story worked was because, you know, one of the challenges, you know, I mean, and you know, and one of the conditions that I am in as a writer is somebody who, you know, has lived in a lot of different places. You can probably hear the vestiges of an English accent. You know, I grew up in London until I was a teenager, and then I moved to the U.S. at that point. And within the U.S., I've lived in a lot of different places, you know, and then abroad again, you know, and then back to the U.S. And if you have a life that is transient like that, you don't have a locality, or even, you know, or a vernacular even that is fully your own. And, you know, and so as a writer then, you know, I mean, I think that, the, you know, with this story in particular, I wanted to just be able to write about place, even though there's no place that really belongs to me or that I belong to. And the way to do this was a travel guide. So, you know, so this story is, you know, this is one approach to, you know, to being a person who is really, you know, sort of not, you know, not at home. You know, but at the same time, very, very interested in place. One of the things about America is that, you know, is that so many of our places are so similar. You know, we've made deliberately a country which is very, very easy to move around. You know, anywhere you go in the state, you find the same chains, the same restaurants, the same hotels, the same gas stations. You know, and you know, and I think that, you know, that that's a, it's part of a country where we do move a lot internally, you know, both for work and also for vacation. But, you know, but it also means that you go looking for something new in a new place and you find the same stuff. And I kind of, in this story, wanted to work against that and to take a landscape that felt to me like it deserved to be re-enchanted in a way. And do that, but you know, but I just, yeah, I, you know, one of the things that I love in, you know, in fiction, particularly the sort of magic realist fiction that I think this story is related to, is fiction that just says, yeah, this isn't real, right? That it declares its fiction, you know, its fictionness, its imaginary nature in the very first line. And so that was what I wanted to do with this story, is just say, right, you know, we're just going to agree, right, we all know this isn't what America is really like, but let's see if we can say some stuff about the country that is real through these, you know, these really extravagant fantasies.
Well, what's so funny about stories like these are, and the reason I like them so much, like if you read and you talk about the mythology of Louisiana, if you're right, if despite our warnings you travel to the place where Louisiana is supposed to be, you will find nothing but a few placards and signs in a Quonset hut containing an exhibition about the myth. So the reason I like that is because I think when you were writing it, you must have smiled or laughed.
Mm.
And that really, I think, to me, it translates really well. And it's just, you know, to me, it's really hard to read that without laughing, because for some reason it's just, it's really funny, and I can't say why.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you think so. I mean, I had a lot of fun writing.
Oh, I can imagine.
For definite. And actually, one time many years ago at a reading, you know, I encountered someone who listened to me read that story out loud and thought I was really arguing. I'm going to do my own spoiling here, but, you know, that I was really arguing, as the story says, that Louisiana doesn't exist, that it's not a real place.
That's even better.
And, you know, I set them straight, you know, rather quickly. But, you know, but it is, you know, it just, you know, I wanted to just invent and this kind of huge canvas of, you know, the whole country. And so, you know, so it was delightful. Once I gave myself permission to do that, it was really fun.
Well, plus it's really cool. I mean, Louisiana, who would think Thomas Jefferson would buy it for $13 million?
Mm-hmm.
It's like one third of the country.
Yeah.
And then that it's still following the Napoleonic Code.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, that's
yeah.
just as strange.
Well, this is, I think, the other thing that you know, I mean, and, you know, as you mentioned, my first novel is historical. One of the things that drew me to that other aspect, you know, that other genre that I'm so interested in, is the more you read about history, you know, the history of the United States, you know, the history of anywhere, really, the more you realize that real life is also, at times, as outlandish as it can possibly get. And, you know, and so, you know, so writing about writing states and, you know, and writing some of the other more surrealistic stories in the book, you know, I really wanted to just say, you know, it's, you know, reality can also sometimes be as bizarre as any of these things that I'm making up.
Well, think about it. I mean, it's like the butterfly effect. I mean, in the beginning, whatever began the revolution here in the United States,
mm-hmm.
it's probably just two guys at a bar. And they're talking about, oh, this is a pain in the ass. We got to do all this stuff for him. He's over there. He's not doing anything for us. And then some third guy hears him talking. He goes, you know what? You guys are right. And then there's three guys. And then a couple other guys say, well, you know, we had a meet about this. And then that's how it starts. It has to start somewhere.
Yeah. Well, and it's very unpredictable.
Exactly.
You know, sort of where, you know, where the events that end up really mattering are going to come from.
Yeah. I don't know how hurricanes, I have no idea how they start. It's just one little flap and that's it. And and then if you travel 180 degrees to Lucille's house, which is a beautiful story. I don't even, where did you find the voice of Lucille's house? Because it's,
yeah,
it rings
really
so...
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah. So, I mean, Lucille's house, I think, comes from two sources. And I'm not sure if this will answer the question about the voice, but it might. And one was I visited the Louis Armstrong House Museum, which is in Corona, Queens, and is in the house where, you know, Lucille Armstrong bought the house in 1943. And she and her husband live there for the rest of their lives. And it is, I mean, it's an absolutely beautifully appointed house. The museum, you know, the foundation that runs it has left the house, you know, sort of as it was when they lived there. And it's a gorgeous work of this person who has clearly, you know, sort of thought enormously carefully about how she wanted this space to be. And it does, you know, seem very much to be her, you know, as, you know, as opposed to just him. You know, and I just, I think, you know, being a person for whom the question of home has always been a bit vexed, I had a sense of this as a place where people had come, you know, who had, you know, also had these very, you know, these lives where they moved around a lot, and they had made a place for themselves here. You know, and so a lot of the, you know, a lot of the details of the story come from, you know, the curator's talk at that museum, you know, which really, really stayed with me after I went home.
I wondered where the wallpaper had come from. Now
yeah,
I kind of know.
You can go and have a look at the wallpaper. It's really intense. It's really amazing.
And then movie night. There was movie night?
Apparently there was movie night. Apparently, yeah. You know, and you know, and the you know, the balcony, and you know, the sort of the sense of the neighborhood, and you know, and the other thing about that house is that it, you know, it's not a gigantically extravagant house. You know, I mean, if you think about you know, Louis Armstrong, one of the greatest musicians of the 20th century, you know, and you would sort of expect his home to be this incredibly grand thing that announces itself. And this house is an ordinary house on an ordinary street in, you know, in Queens. And so I think for me that also was, you know, this really appealing aspect of it, you know, that it's home, you know, and they didn't, you know, they didn't move to someplace grander. They just wanted to stay there. So that was part of it. And then the other source for this story, you know, the writer James Salter just passed away, and he was somebody whose work I really, really loved and admired, and in particular his stories. And he has a story from, I think, the mid-1980s, I'm going to guess 1986, called American Express, which is a story about, you know, two friends from college and their kind of meteoric rise to great financial success. They become lawyers and, you know, and they make their way in the world and become extremely prosperous. And the direction of that story seems to be, you know, the thing that story seems to be saying is that there's something about American life that kind of rushes us through and doesn't give us a chance to look around. And we're so absorbed in getting and spending that we don't take time for things that actually, you know, matter in our lives, the day-to-day experience of being alive in the world. And so part of this story, I think, was me, not quite consciously, but partly deliberately, wanting to respond to that and say, you know, there are other modes, you know, and particularly characteristically American modes of life, where, you know, which are all about making beauty and making connection.
Yeah, there's so many times a week that I think of John Lennon saying, you know, life is what happens when you're busy planning other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, and that's why, you know, I understand that you're being diplomatic about Facebook and other social media. But, you know, there are studies that say that kids are losing the ability to recognize facial expressions. And they are. I mean, I can, you can understand a look that's sardonic, a look that's cynical or sarcastic, but I don't really think that kids will be able to do so.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, the thing is, in a way, I wouldn't be surprised if that was true. You know, we do live in this time when technology is, you know, is so much an object of our affection and so much of what we spend our time relating to that I can't imagine that it isn't going to change us. And yet, I always hesitate because we have been worried about this same question of how our modern technological world is going to change us. You know, for hundreds of years, you know, there's a part in the preface to the Lyrical Ballads where Wordsworth worries about the bad effects of cities and their bright lights and distractions on the mind of the youth. And, you know, and so, you know, so on the one hand, you know, it, I think the effects are real, right? And we should be thinking about them and talking about them deliberately. And on the other hand, we do seem to have some aspects of our humanity, you know, which are... I mean, you know, for good and ill, which remain the same over time. So, you know, so I think, yeah, I mean, you know, it, I think, you know, the stories in the book that deal with technology wouldn't work if the anxiety, you know, the apprehension that we have wasn't real, right? I think, you know, we should be concerned about how our technology might change us. But at the same time, you know, I mean, and that seems to me to also be what that story Lucille's House is about, is, you know, recording technology, which was, you know, over the course of Armstrong's career, this new thing that came into being, you know, the recorded pop song.
And it's only at the end of the story that Lucille realizes, oh, wait a minute, I can still access my husband.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and so that's an example of technology being this thing that genuinely brings people closer together and enables, you know, and enables them to be in touch with each other in a way that is completely real. So, you know, so it's not so much that I'm being diplomatic as that I really am a person who goes back and forth on this question, you know. Is it good or bad? Well, I don't know yet, but it's really interesting.
I know it's interesting because we could talk about it for the next 5 hours and not reach any conclusion. So, instead of doing that, let's move on to the other story that stays way out of the realm of science fiction, which is No-No. And that's another one where the voice had to come from somewhere. Maybe you had a similar, maybe you visited the internment camps. I don't know.
Yeah, I did. You know, during the period of time when my, you know, my husband and I lived in California for a while, we were on a road trip and we kind of came across Manzanar. You know, without having completely intended to go there, and we just saw it and thought, you know, we're here, we have to go and see what this place was like. And it's such a strange part, I mean, it's such a strange spot on the world, you know, because deliberately, of course, it is in the middle of absolutely nowhere. You know, it's a desert, it's, there are mountains, there's no human settlement around, and then in the midst of this vacancy, there are still today left, you know, the kind of outlines and some of the structures of what was an absolutely massive camp where they moved people, you know, after the evacuation order, you know, from the cities of the West Coast. And, you know, I had, you know, I lived in Japan for a little while during college, you know, and so it's a, you know, it's a culture and a literary tradition that I've always been very, very interested in. And so one of the things that I wanted to attempt in that story, you know, was, you know, was to try to, you know, not mimic but evoke some of the, you know, the aesthetic of, you know, that you often find in Japanese prose, you know, like, you know, the stories of Yasunari Kawabata, you know, this sense of unhurriedness and of clarity and of objects kind of placed before you for your perusal. You know, I mean, in contrast to the other stories of the book, which some of them have this kind of very racing kind of urgency to them, I really wanted this to be a story that took its time. You know, and the characters are in a desert, right, literal and, you know, I mean, external an internal, a place where nothing happens, right? Everything has been suspended. And so the story is intended to give you some of what I imagine that feeling might have been like.
And also, it hinges on one decision by one man. And then, as you say, there's dialogue that's based on that decision where there he's approached, asked a question, he answers the question. And as you say, in a very, not passive, but in a very clear-cut way, the discussion. And then, you know, there's an enormous courage, and at some points there's an enormous guilt. And those two kind of mesh together and based on the same decision. And, yeah, so it's definitely of a different tone, but it probably leaves you with more of a feeling of, it wasn't sadness, I don't know what the feeling was, but it leaves you with more of a certain feeling than the other ones.
Yeah, and well, it's definitely a story where I wanted, I mean, that's a story, you know, of all of the ones in this book that I think went through more drafts than any of the rest.
I can see that.
And one of the reasons is because it's not resolvable. You know, the situation that the character and characters are in is so terrible and dwarfs, you know, dwarfs their ability to make choices about it. You know, I think one of the things that, you know, that I think, I mean, this story, you know, is very different from the ones that you know, that are on either side of it, but, you know, one of the effects of being caught up in, you know, in kind of bigger, you know, by bigger forces and in, you know, in larger historical moments is that sometimes what you decide to do isn't the most important thing. So this character, you know, in the story, Nono, has to make a choice about, you know, how to declare himself. But in the end, it's not a choice between right and wrong, simply, right? You know, it's a much more complicated thing. And in a sense, you know, he doesn't have a good option. You know, he's not the person in charge of his own life at this point.
Well, if you're talking about
scope for action is really small.
If you're talking about science fiction and even the science fiction type things you're writing, America likes to give fake choices to people, and that was a fake choice. It wasn't really a choice. You said one thing and something happened. You said one thing and something else happened. You didn't have the choice there at all. And it's like, I've always thought, because apparently I am less optimistic than you, I've always thought that, you know, we just have this very, very thin veneer of civilization, like the little crust on top of creme brulee, and you just tap it with a spoon, and this will happen again. I mean, it does happen again. And what we did was horrible, and then, you know, 30 years later, you give them $10,000 a piece and say, hey, we're sorry. We can't give you your stuff back or your house, but, you know, we're sorry. And or with Native Americans. And it'll just keep happening. And right now, around the rest of the world where we ignore it, you know, but this year there's 60 million people displaced this year in the world. Not that we care that much about it, me as a good left-leaning Democrat can talk about it all the time and not do anything. But, yeah, I mean, and I guess the science fiction aspect of it would be for you to write a story about this occurring 30 years from now. When, you know, my adopted Chinese daughters are in the same situation, heaven forbid. And
yeah, well, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's one of the tasks of science fiction, right, is to imagine the way in which the currents of the past or the present might actually manifest themselves in the future. But I do think it's interesting what you say about, you know, about our great affection for the idea of choice in the United States, because I think that that's true. You know, one of my experiences, you know, after my family moved here was, you know, that impressed itself on me in a very enduring way was going to the supermarket. You know, and in, you know, even, you know, I mean, we moved from Great Britain, right? So an affluent English-speaking country, you're not really that different in the grand scheme of things. And yet, when you go into an American supermarket, you are overwhelmed with, you know, a billion kinds of toothpaste and a zillion kinds of breakfast cereal. And I would in no way want to reduce, you know, the way that we think about ourselves to that. But it is true, you know, that we really, we put a great deal of emphasis on choice in a way that sometimes doesn't have depth to it, I think, you know, a lot of the stories kind of are trying to ask questions about you know, if you appear to have a decision to make, but, you know, the conditions of that decision make it so difficult, or make the choice that you would make, that both sides of it end up being equivalent, that it ultimately isn't the most meaningful thing.
Yeah, and he has to change it, and that's what the story's about. Mm-hmm. But before we go any further, since we talked about this before, let's talk about the cover of the book. Because I love the cover, and I think it relates to the one story, which is viral. Mm. In my mind, I don't know if it does in your mind.
Mm-hmm. No, very much so.
And, it's this idea that exactly all the things we've been talking about what will happen when a critical mass is reached, and we no longer have the ability to control, or control is taken away from us, or we decide this is what we're going to do, like in And So I Fly Away, in your Insomnia book, which was a great way to end that story because...
Thank you.
Because, again, the reader's left to decide. Although I made a decision, but the reader's left to decide. So did you vet this cover? Did you pick it?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I had, what they call cover consultation, which means that I think if I had absolutely hated it, then they would have been okay to find another one. But my editor sent this to me, and immediately I was like, yes, that's the cover. I think they made it look really nice. I also think that, it captures, for listeners who haven't, who haven't seen it, the cover is a giant, it's a firework exploding and people looking up at it, but it isn't immediately clear what you're actually looking at, and so it connects those scary, the sort of scary aspects of technology with the wonder of it, in a way that I just thought was really great. As soon as I saw this, I was like, yes, that's what I would like my book to look like. That looks fine.
Plus, what people forget or may not notice is, that viral stories, Emily Mitchell, and then on the spine and on the back, you basically have text messages, which it really does give you pause because you look at it and you go, wait a minute, this isn't the way a book's supposed to look. Mm-hmm. This is the way it looks like when I'm texting on my iPhone.
Yeah. I love the fact that it's kind of...
your title.
It's reverse engineered like that, right? So in the older form, you have the newer form. It's like a parody of a text message. It's really nice.
Yeah, and you even got them to raise the letters, too, and put gloss on it. How'd you do that?
Oh, no, that was all them, actually. I have to give credit where credit is due. Norton make really nice-looking books in general.
They do.
And this, they did with my first book, and this one I was really happy with how they made it look as well.
Well, so... Do you continue to, like your new project now, which is sounds like a fairly massive one, do you continue when you take breaks, which I wish I could do that at all, take breaks and write stories for fun?
I mean, I do. I'm at a stage, I'm working on a novel, and I'm at a stage where it's kind of taking all of the attention that I have. I think... a novel is like driving in heavy traffic. So you go and then you stop. And then you're stuck and you don't know when you're going to get unstuck. And so for me, the points where, in that very, very unpredictable process where I'm not moving forward, those are times when sometimes I'll duck out to the side and write a story. And right now the novel is moving forward, albeit slowly. I do think that there are times when a long narrative demands all of your attention. But I definitely want to continue writing stories. It's a form that I absolutely love. And, I remember from looking, you had interviewed, George Saunders, who is, doing such incredibly moving and extraordinary things in the form of the short story. How could I possibly not want to work in this genre? There's tremendously exciting stuff happening in it. And I actually think, after quite a few years in which, short stories were not getting a ton of attention, we're having a moment where there's been, quite a few books of stories, that people have found a really wide readership and have gotten the acclaim that they deserve. In a way, writing a story is for me the most fun type of writing that I've discovered yet. So.
It's funny, when I was talking to George Saunders, it was kind of like we had our little short story ourselves going, because it was the 10th of December, and we were talking about one of the really morose stories. And I was saying, you know, it's really depressing. I feel like I need therapy after writing this, because what am I going to do? It's basically it. I'm going to die, and that's it. He goes, yes, Sam, pretty much you're just going to get older, then you're going to get sicker, and then you're going to die. And I said, well, you know, that's, you know, what kind of thing is that to say? It's not really, you know, 100% true. And he goes, no, it's true. You're going to get old, you're going to get sick, and you're going to die. And I think that's pretty much how we ended the interview. But it was like,
The thing is that somehow, you know, in the context of a Saunders story, that truth becomes incredibly amusing. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, and sometimes very enlivening. I mean, you know, I loved that collection. And one of the things I loved about it is that sort of even in the midst of these terrible situations that he paints, there are these moments when the characters manage, nevertheless, to actually discern what the right thing to do is and do it with great courage, you know, and then also... you know, it's some of the funniest work.
Being human is. I think that's basically being human. And I think, like, I always think back to Jesus, and I always go, you know, God says, you got to do this. And Jesus is going, no, seriously, I really do not want to do this. And God's going, nope, sorry, you have to do it. And he goes, come on, give me a break. I do not want to do this. And it's like finally saying, all right, I'm seriously, I don't want to do it, but I will do it.
Yeah, and that's what being human is. Yeah,
it's...
no, I think that's exactly right. And the thing that is so interesting, you know, I mean, and this is one of the things that I was going for in these stories, you know, sort of trying to get at, you know, in the stories in Viral, is that that is essential to being human, you know, accepting that, you know, inevitability that you're not going to be around forever, and nevertheless finding a way to do the thing that is good and right and generous. And also the fact that we spend a lot of our time as human beings not really being human. And that also interests me, you know, that the fact that we wind ourselves up about nothing and that we worry about things that don't matter, and that we seem to continue to do that even though intellectually we know better.
I wanted to talk about every story, but we don't have time, so now I want to talk about, since just what you're talking about, being human and not being human, because that's the last sentence of this story. It's like, oh, that was really good, Sam. is the spider story. So that's your most hardcore, which isn't hardcore, but it's the most hardcore science fiction story in the book, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, in the sense that it involves a technological innovation, you know, that is imaginary so far.
You can talk a little bit about that without giving it away, can't you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, so the story My Daughter and Her Spider, the premise is a woman who has a small daughter and her marriage has just recently ended, and her daughter is having some real trouble coping, you know, with with her parents' breakup. The mom in the story takes her daughter to get an artificial pet, a robotic pet. You know, this is a world in which that has become preferable and normalized, you know, better than having a real pet, to help her cope with it. And the pet that she chooses of all of these extraordinary options that she has is a giant robotic spider, you know, about the size of a salad plate. And they bring the spider home, and then they have to live in the house with this giant, ominous-looking you know, creature that's not a creature, and they don't know quite how intelligent it is, and the story unfolds from there. And I think, you know, that this is, it's a story that is, you know, that is about that uneasiness that we have about how sentient our technology is. You know, the characters in the story are not sure how much the spider knows about what they're saying about it. And the mother really doesn't like it, and it becomes the focus for all of her anxieties about herself as a parent and a person, and she has to ultimately decide, you know, what to do about the fact that she doesn't like this thing that is now living, or not really living, in her home.
Well, it's like what you were saying about technology. She's the one that should be helping her daughter, and she's not because she's unable to.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that's what I want the story to kind of get around to. You know, that, like, the first story is a first person story, and, you know, and so she is narrating this experience. So she's not 100% honest about the degree to which she is, you know, really opting out of her responsibilities as a parent. You know, and I think, you know, this is something that, you know, that seemed to me, you know, we do have such strong images of what domestic life should be like. And, you know, here is this woman dealing with her daughter who has tantrums and who is really, you know, genuinely difficult to look after. But she just decides at a certain point that she doesn't want to deal with it anymore. And so, you know, so what happens is as much her fault as anything.
But you kind of told what the meaning of the story, which is not entirely the meaning that I took away from it.
Mm.
The meaning I took away from it is the last sentence,
mm-hmm.
which is that in that reality, maybe she, first of all, she doesn't like spiders. She doesn't
mm-hmm.
like the web thingy that's going on.
Mm.
But at the end, she's confused because, again, without giving, I'm not giving anything away. She's confused because what's happening may be actually the same thing she's doing for her. And what's happening may be the thing that's helping her too.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
it's not human. She's confused. It's not mm-hmm. human. She's convincing herself it's not.
Yeah. No, I think that that's exactly what I was hoping the story would convey. Because I do think, you know, we think of computers, we think of technology, we think of our phones increasingly as persons. You know, I think it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting thing that, you know, I have a smartphone, you know, like almost everybody else in the developed world. And, you know, and sometimes I'll thank Siri.
I do too.
When I arrive somewhere, and I know that Siri is not a real human being. You know, I'm completely aware of that, and nevertheless, the impulse to, you know, to treat something that appears to be sentient as though it is sentient is something that we can't avoid. And so, you know, so that is, this is sort of that idea taken to the next iteration, you know, where it, you know, the machine appears more and more lifelike and more confusingly lifelike. And I also wanted, you know, I mean, I'm a terrible arachnophobe, like a lot of people.
Oh,
you
I
know,
love
it
spiders.
Remains the one type of creature that I have, you know, a really exaggerated, fearful reaction to. You know, I don't mind snakes and I don't mind insects, but spiders really, really continue, you know, to scare me in a way that they used to when I was a child. And what I wanted to ask is sort of, you know, that anxiety, what is underneath that if you take the lid off? You know, is it really completely hatred, or is there also curiosity and, you know, and other feelings, you know, that are involved in that antipathy as well?
I'll ask you one final question.
Mm-hmm.
So is your Siri have a British accent?
No, my Siri is just a regular American Siri. Yeah.
So my iPhone has a female Siri British accent, and my iPad Mini has a Siri Australian accent.
I've heard the Australian accent, actually. I think if I was going to change the accent on my Siri, it might be to that.
The only problem is she doesn't understand me all the time. And my mom is always my mom for either of them. But I really enjoy it. It's like listening to you. It's very pleasing to me. So anyway, we've been talking for what? Look, 56 minutes. I could go on forever. This was fun.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. It's really fun for me, too.
No, I'm glad you're happy to be here, because I always wonder, why would anyone want to talk to me? But it's nice that you said that. I really appreciate that.
Oh, no. Well, you know, I mean, it's such a nice opportunity to, you know, to talk to you and, you know, and to talk about the book. And, you know, you ask such great questions, like,
it's different than being.
Would it not be fun?
It's different than being interviewed by Terry Gross.
Yes, it is certainly that.
Okay. Well, hopefully, we'll talk again soon.
Yeah. Well. Yes. And you know. And thank you so much.
That was Emily Mitchell talking about her new book, Viral, which actually comes out in a couple of days, 29th, published by Norton. It's in paperback, or at least my ARC's in paperback. You know, I should have asked her. and it's got a great cover. The stories, seriously, if you, it's not really science fiction, but if you like science fiction or if you like stuff that's just a little off, I guarantee you, just set aside a little bit of time. It's only 200 pages. Oh, and I didn't ask a really important question. Darn it. About her last one. Shoot. Anyway, 200 pages, you can read it in an hour or two, and each story is still going to stay with you. It's not like you read it and you miss it. They're all, it's all laying out there. Not in a bad way, but it's laying out there in a way that says, here, do with this what you will. And I like those kinds of books. And that's why I like short stories so much. We were talking about George Saunders in 10th of December. It was so nice that she listens to my interviews. Who knew? Why don't you guys listen to them? Anyway, so join us every week on the Avid Reader. I would give you a list, but we're jockeying them around. We got a whole bunch of new ones that's going to last us all the way through summer. But what I want to do is play with them so that we don't broadcast them until like this one, which will be released in 2 days. So that guys gives you guys like a sneak peek, like a preview of what's coming out, like a trailer. And that's what I like to do rather than wait a couple months after it's released. And that's where we got Gone Girl. We got Gone Girl before it was really popular, and Girl on a Train. And that makes a big difference, I think, both as Rebecca, our producer, works so hard to get, and for me, interviewing somebody whose book is not yet so popular that I know the questions that are supposed to be asked. Not that I would ask them, but in any event. Okay, I'm done with my hour. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll talk again next week here on the Avid Reader.